Anderson, welcome to the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.
Jordan, it's great to be here.
For people who maybe aren't familiar with you, you know, in Bitcoin circles, you're really well known. But for, you know, people outside that, maybe not as much. So why don't you introduce yourself, who you are, what you do?
Yeah, I'm Mike Peterson. I'm the director of MissionSake, which is a missionary support organization here in El Salvador. And then also the founder of Bitcoin Beach, which was kind of it started as a community project here in El Zante, El Salvador, and kind of grew really worldwide from there. Just basically using Bitcoin to teach financial lessons and really to see financial development happen. And so that's kind of wear both those hats now.
Yeah. Well, okay. So let's just kind of get started. Like, how did you guys end up? Like, what's your testimony? How did you come to know the Lord? What did that process look like?
Yeah, so grew up in a Christian family. My parents actually came to the Christian faith just right after I was born. They had actually separated during that time, and both separately had come to faith and then came back together, and so. Grew up in, you know, a very loving Christian family, and, you know, our faith was always very core to everything that our family did. And, you know, obviously as I got older, the faith was, you know, kind of made that switch from being my parents to being my own. Was always very involved with, you know, church growing up with the youth group, and then attended Westmont College, which is a Christian liberal arts college in Santa Barbara. Actually, my daughter's attending there now. Met my wife there.
So, and you grew up in California?
Yeah. Grew up in San Clemente, California, and then moved to San Diego, when I was in junior high school.
Gotcha. So you grew up there, you're going to church, you decided, you know, what did you end up studying in college?
I studied business in college. Was always been kind of really drawn to finance and the business world. And then after college, I actually took over my grandfather's business. He had a food service business. It was seasonal. And so I worked for him. That's kind of how I put myself through college. And when I graduated, he offered to sell it. And so, yeah.
Wow. So what was that business?
So we would do, we had a number of different food trailers that we'd operate at big events and fairs that they have in California. So they have these big events where they'll get 1.5 million people over a 5-week period.
Wow.
And so we would kind of go from event to event, and, you know, it was crazy hours. You're working 120 hours a week. But then it also provided a lot of free time the rest of the year. So we would work 5 months a year and have, you know, a lot of time off the rest of the year.
What kind of, this is the foodie in me, I was curious, what kind of food was it that you're...
So originally when I took it over from my grandfather, it was just kind of more like bottled drinks and churros and, you know, ice creams and things like that. We grew it into more specialty things. So, and part of it came from I love to travel and have traveled extensively. And I love like the fresh churros that you see in like Spain or parts of Mexico. And so we developed this fusion item that we called the Mexican funnel cake. It was like bringing the Dutch funnel cake and churros together. And so I had a stand that was devoted to that. And then we had another stand that was devoted to bacon that we just did. It was a huge barbecue operation. You know, it was like 10 different trailers that, you know, kind of formed it. And we would do, our signature item was a bacon wrapped turkey leg. So we would take a 2-pound turkey leg and wrap it with a pound of bacon and slow cook it. And that was, everything in that stand was bacon focused.
It's so, okay, so you start with that, and then I know, like, I mean, in recent years, you guys have, you know, you guys were running, like, a fair or something like that. How long have you been doing that for? Is that something that goes back years, too?
So that's the same thing. So that was the fairs.
Okay.
Was the where we would operate these,
gotcha.
these food stands.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, you have to, before we move on, because obviously we're going to get into more, eternally important things, and even just geopolitically important things, but... I do recall you telling me that you guys like made the Today Show or something because of some of the creations, the culinary creations that you guys did.
Yeah, we would always be very focused on media. Our business was very media driven, And especially at those events, people were looking for something, you know, crazy things they couldn't get anywhere else. Sure. And so, yeah, the one year our new item was deep fried Starbucks. And so we took Starbucks, you know, and part of it is just the marketing gimmick and, you know, kind of clickbait type.
Yeah, yeah.
But we took Starbucks coffee beans and ground them really fine and then mixed them with chocolate. And then encased them in this sweet pastry dough. So they were in the middle of that and then deep fried it and then covered it with whipped cream. So you had that like coffee and sugar and cream like together. And it was actually really good. We served it in a Starbucks coffee cup. It was one of those.
How did you get the Starbucks?
You can buy them on like Amazon and there's different places because they have a lot of distribution deals with people that they use their
coffee. Gotcha.
So we did get a cease and desist letter from them about 6 weeks in because I think just because it was on Good Morning America and, you know, a bunch of other things. And so they actually tracked us down and sent a lawyer out to the fair and hand delivered it. So.
So you just switched it to deep fried.
We just switched it to deep fried coffee. It didn't have the same ring to it. But by then, you know, it had already become kind of something that was it kind of gone viral. So,
So man, it's almost one of those things where it's almost worth it. I mean, it's worth it kind of to do stuff like that. If you know you're just going to get the cease and desist, you know, you just do it, make hay while the sun shines, and then. And then just pull back and, you know, comply when you have to.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. It's better to ask for forgiveness and permission. And,
yeah.
I mean, we'd actually done a number of different things like that. That was the first time that we ever had anybody. And I think that's just because it really went so viral at that time. But, yeah. But we did, with another item we had bacon-wrapped Jack Daniels. And we had... we would take this. We had another type of pastry that we would wrap in bacon, and then we would Jack Daniels in it and then barbecue it, so that the alcohol would like cook off, but it still had that like flavor to it. And so the people would be like, "How can you have bacon wrapped Jack Daniels?" And so so we were always doing, you know, unique things like that. And it's funny because that's a totally different world, but. My experience over the years and understanding how media works and what drives things actually was very relevant to when we started the Bitcoin Beach project, because I understood these are the type of things that get journalists interested. You know, you kind of can serve it up to them an easy story that they know are going to get lots of views.
So is that something you started thinking about in business school? I mean, when you were studying business, or is this just, were you kind of always, you had like a marketing bent to you? That was just something you kind of were always thinking in those terms.
I mean, it was more just from the business side, just realizing that marketing drives things. We saw a big shift in the food business where I started realizing that people would often buy things based on what would look good on their Instagram page. And so I'd watch people spend like $20 on an item and then like take a couple pictures with it and then throw it away. Like that was like what was driving things. And so we realized that, you know, kind of tapping into media, you know, really could drive sales. And so that became a big feature of our business.
Okay, so you're working 5 months a year. You're doing that. How old are you at this point when you're doing this? This is like right out of college.
Yeah, so right out of college, I took that over, and so so did that. We just recently sold that business, but so we had did that for I guess it was like 28 years that I ran it, and I had worked for my grandfather for probably 12 years before that. So was actually in that for quite from when I was illegally young to be working in that business till just this last year. But it gave us, you know, like I said, it gave us the freedom the other part of the year to do other things that we loved, and eventually led to us moving down to El Salvador.
Yeah. So what were some of those other things? I know, so you've written a book. What's the name of the book?
So the title of the book is Four Souls, A Search for Epic Life. And that was after I graduated from Westmont, I had these three other guys that I had a deep relationship with, and we really wanted to see what was out there in the world. We had all done a Europe semester program together and like traveled over Europe, but we wanted to get into the more, the third world developing countries and see what else was out there. And so we hashed this plan to take a year off after graduation and really just spend that time traveling really across the globe and working with different people in the communities in the different places. Most of them, related to church efforts that were going on, but and working with a number of different missionaries. And it was a very like bare bones trip. I think we did the whole trip for about $6,000 each, and about half of that was on airfare. Obviously, things were cheaper then in general, but yeah, we were living on a few dollars a day, sleeping on dirt floors, But it was just an amazing experience.
So what were some of the countries you visited?
So we started off, we drove, somebody donated a vehicle that they wanted us to get to some doctors in Guatemala. So we drove through Mexico to Guatemala in this pickup truck I had donated. And then from there, we went to Russia, and we were in the far north of Russia and Siberia region, working with an organization called Athletes in Action. Traveled down through to Europe. Spent a small stint in Egypt, and then in South Africa in the Kingdom of Lesotho. We were working at a seminary there. And then from there, we went to India and kind of crisscrossed across India, working with a number of different organizations there. And then into Bangladesh, where we were working with Campus Crusade. And then where did we go from there? Then we went into Thailand, and we brought a bunch of Bibles into Vietnam from Thailand. It was illegal to bring Bibles in, but there's a lot of the churches there were desperate to get a hold of Bibles. So we kind of smuggled those into to Vietnam and worked with the underground church there for a while, and then kind of finished off in China.
Wow. Man, that's incredible. So this is over the course of a year?
Yeah. So it was a little bit less than a year. It was definitely a wild trip. And then when we came back, we just felt like we had spent time with just so many amazing people in the church in different countries. And we felt like we wanted to get their stories out. And so we decided that we would go ahead and write a book. And so we actually moved to Big Bear, California, which is kind of the mountain area. And so we would snowboard, during the day and write the book at night and do a little substitute teaching to be able to pay for it all. And we actually got a publishing deal from that with Zondervan. And that book came out. It was probably a couple-year process to actually get the book all done and ready to go out. And then, which was probably even more crazy of us than our original trip, we decided we would do a book tour with our wives
You about this, yeah.
in a giant RV. And so one of the guys couldn't go. He was in seminary during that time, but three of us and our wives, I think my buddy Jen, I think they'd only been married a couple months. We thought it'd be a great idea to, spend 6 months traveling across country speaking, in this RV with our wives. And it was... obviously there were some challenges along the way being in those close quarters, but it turned out to be an amazing experience and, lots of amazing stories that came out of that. So,
yeah, we were talking about that with you when we were with you this past fall in El Salvador. We were like, yeah, it's one of those things that a recently married guy, I could totally see a recently married guy just like, hey, this would be great. Three guys sitting around and talking about this. Yeah, this would be great.
Well, we'll be with our best friends. We'll be with our wives. It'd be amazing. So definitely the wives had to smack us upside the head a few times and inform us that being together in a group all day was not spending quality time with them. So you had to carve out some ways to make that work along the way.
And you guys ended up cutting the trip short, right? It ended up not being as long as you thought?
No, we still did the whole trip. My wife and I had to leave a little bit early just to get back to run our business. So, because our summer season was starting. But we're still great friends with all of them. In fact, The three guys I wrote the book with are coming down in a couple of weeks to El Salvador.
No way.
We have these kind of annual get-togethers. So,
oh, that's so cool. And so, and then, but in Peter, I mean, Peter, he at least lives for part of the year down there, right?
Yeah. So Peter was not one of those, guys. Oh, Peter was, we actually met him in El Salvador. He was pastor at the Union Church here. Yeah.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. That's, I need to get Peter on.
Yeah.
I need to,
oh, he has an amazing testimony, amazing story.
Yeah. Just stunning. Okay. So you guys get down there, you're traveling back and forth. You're, you know, spending your summers probably, or is that kind of your busy season?
Yeah. So the El Salvador thing came a couple of years later. I came down here on a surf trip and with a buddy and just really fell in love with the country. And because we had all this time off in the winter and I loved to surf, but wasn't getting much opportunity to, just because the summer is the prime time for that and we were working. So this is perfect. You know, this place is warm year round and has great waves. Yeah. And so I called my wife up and said, "Hey, we have to come back and buy a place in El Salvador." And a month later we flew back and put an offer on a place and, kind of started this new chapter in our lives.
Yeah. And so again, what was the connection to El Salvador? How did you hear about it in the first place? And then El Zonte, like, what was the connection there?
There was no connection other than I knew El Salvador had great surf and there was cheap tickets at the time that I was looking to go on the surf trip. So, and I like to explore, you know, I've traveled to, I think, you know, close to 50 countries now. And so it was a place I hadn't been and I was like, okay, this is another place to go explore.
Yeah. And then the El Zante part of it was just, that's just kind of where people told you they had good surfing there.
Yeah, we had originally stayed at another place that was nearby and we were looking for properties there but couldn't find anything. And the real estate agent we were working with owned the house in El Zante and said, "Hey, why don't you check out this other community?" And we did and we loved it. And so, yeah, it was really just one of those things that, you know, whether you want to say it was all by chance or that it was, you know, part of God's plan, like it was something that we kind of just fell into.
Yeah. And so again, you obviously end up moving there. Did you found Mission Sake to go there or did Mission Sake already kind of exist or, you know, what was the impetus for starting Mission Sake?
So originally the reason that we bought the place here was just for vacation and to have a place to, you know, come down to. But as we started spending a lot of time in El Salvador, we started attending a church in the capital city and it was the only English-speaking church. So you would have a lot of the missionaries would attend there, at least some of the time. Some of them would attend all the time, but other ones that had their own churches would, you know, just attend when they could. And we started getting to know a lot of these, you know, families that were, you know, running children's homes or working with women who had been victims of sex trafficking or were planting churches. And at that time, El Salvador had the highest murder rate in the world. And so it was a very harrowing place for them to do ministry. They felt, you know, like they were kind of prisoners in their homes, you know, outside of the times they were at their ministries. A lot of them actually lived, you know, on the grounds of the ministry. And so there was kind of, they're working 24/7, a lot of burnout, you know, not kind of healthy times to take away just with their families. And so we started inviting a number of these families down to the beach, which was a very different environment than the capital city.
Okay.
And we became kind of the safe people that they could talk to about the things they were struggling with, just how difficult life was, marital problems, you know, things their kids were going through. And we really felt like, hey, this is a way that we can serve all these amazing families here that have made this huge sacrifice, is just trying to help support them. Give them the time and space they need to, you know, kind of rejuvenate themselves and also try to bring like a sense of teamwork and camaraderie to the community. Cause you had all these people that kind of felt like they're off there, you know, out there by themselves. And, and sometimes there's this weird sense of competition or suspicion, even what amidst that group. You were on the mission field, so you understand how that is. And so a lot of times they were, they were struggling so bad in their own lives. And so they assumed everybody else had it all together and they didn't want to connect with others because they're afraid they would see, you know, how screwed up they were. And so, so the idea was to kind of bring just a sense of cohesiveness and camaraderie to the missionary community, that they can kind of, you know, help each other, back each other up. And that was kind of where that was born from, is we could come here and actually help these families that are serving be more effective, healthier, and hopefully, you know, have much bigger impact on the country of El Salvador because of that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and like I don't know what the term is, that's not recidivism, but like the rate of missionaries leaving the field, like that, I mean, that's a real thing. And, you know, like burnout is definitely one of those reasons. You have other, one of the biggest reasons is because, you know, there's like disagreements among missionaries, the missionaries themselves.
Yeah.
The conflict among missionaries is a huge reason why, you know, some people come back to the States. Child rearing. Like a lot of the same things that can cause problems in churches here, I mean, it happens there, and there's a lot less, you know, margin to help you, you know, kind of navigate those things.
You don't have the support network, and you also, a lot of times they feel like they can't be honest about their struggles because a lot of the people that would be the ones they turn to are the ones that are financially supporting them. And so they feel like, oh, they know how screwed up we are, then, you know, they're not going to want to support what we're doing anymore. Yeah. So it's all these different things. And so that's why you see a lot of times these problems aren't addressed early, and people don't find out about them until kind of people go off the rails.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Okay. So you guys kind of, I mean, what was the time period between, you know, coming to El Salvador and recognizing the missionary need, and actually founding Mission Sake and you guys, you know, at least moving there for part of the year? What did that?
So it was probably about 7 years before we kind of came up with the idea. And then it took us a few years before my wife could be convinced that we should do it.
Yeah.
And when I first told her, she's like, you're insane. I'm not moving to El Salvador. So,
yeah.
And you got to understand at that time, you know, it had the highest murder rate in the world, it was much less developed than it is now. So it was, you know, it was a big ask.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. And so again, you guys had little kids at that time?
Yeah. So when we moved down, I think my oldest was 9 and my daughter Eliana was 9 and my son was 7.
Okay.
So when we first started coming down, my son wasn't even born yet. So we like to tell him he was hecho in El Salvador, made in El Salvador. He's like, Dad, don't say that.
Poke out my mind's eye, Dad. What's going on?
Yeah.
Okay, so you guys get there, you guys start getting set up, and like, what is kind of what was the transition point? I mean, how many years, I guess, did you minister to, you know, the missionaries before the kind of the Bitcoin side of things started happening?
So it was probably 3 or 4 years before that started developing. We pretty early on decided, so we a component of what we were doing is we had 2 missionary guest homes that the missionaries could go just for a time of respite. That was one of the things we saw, that most of them just didn't have a budget for any type of vacation, or they felt guilty because they, you know, they have people supporting them, and so they felt like guilty and they couldn't really go on vacation or spend money on that. So we had 2 guest homes that we built where they could go and stay free of charge, and in 2 different communities on opposite sides of the country. One was in El Zante, where we live, and which has subsequently been a place, you know, a lot of people know as Bitcoin Beach now. The other was in Punta Mongo. And we felt like, just as part of being neighbors and part of that community, that even though it wasn't our primary mission, we wanted to have an impact on the local community and find ways to, you know, just to be involved as neighbors. And specifically in El Zante, where we're living, we had a guy that was working for us. He was kind of like my right-hand man, Jorge, and he really had a vision for the youth in the community. He, you know, had kind of the typical story of didn't really know his dad growing up because he left very early on to go work in the U.S. And, you know, he had kind of, you know, gotten in trouble in different ways in his youth, and you know, wanted to be able to mentor and be there for the youth in a way that he hadn't had somebody there. And, and specifically at this time, the gangs had a huge presence and were recruiting, you know, the majority of the kids. And so it was seen as like, this is a way that, that we can kind of, you know, minister to these kids, but also try to keep them out of gangs and show them there's different alternatives. And so that was originally how things started was, you know, we would have like a weekly Bible study. We built a little skate park for the kids that, you know, they'd spend time with them. They would, you know, take them to the beach to go surfing. It was a lot of that sort of thing. And then, you know, there was the youth group component to it. And then it became more like, hey, let's try to help these kids stay in school by doing tutoring and things like that, which led to, you know, seeing that teaching them English really opened up a whole nother world of opportunities to them, both educationally and vocationally, that if they knew English, they could earn significantly more and have a lot more opportunity. Yeah. And so when we had somebody that kind of heard what we were doing and wanted to donate to it, but specifically wanted to donate in Bitcoin and had all these restrictions that came along with that. And so that was how the, you know, what we were doing there eventually came and took on a life of its own as Bitcoin Beach.
All right. So what did this, I mean, how did this guy hear about, we don't need to get into like details about him or whoever this was, but like, do you know how he found you in the first place, or what, like, what did that process look like?
So it was actually connected to a retreat we would do every year. We would, you know, as I told you before, we really wanted to see unity within the missionary community in El Salvador. And so one of the things we would do to try to stimulate that, but also just a time of respite for and a time for people to take a break from their work, was we would do a retreat once a year at a beach resort in El Salvador and bring all the missionaries, you know, together for this weekend. And we had an individual that came down that ran a marriage ministry that was focused primarily for pastors, but they also worked with a number of missionaries, and him and his wife came down to speak on marital health issues during the conference. And he heard that I was one of these crazy Bitcoin people. And so he came to me and said, hey, we had somebody that has donated a Bitcoin to us, and we have no idea like what to do with it, or, you know, what can we do with this Bitcoin? And so I was fascinated by it. I was like, oh, really? That's awesome. And, you know, kind of walked through different ways that they might be able to use it, and, you know, didn't really think anything else of it. And a few months later, he called me and he said, hey, would you want me to try to connect you with this donor and see if they would want to support the work that you guys are doing in El Salvador? And yeah, I mean, why not? I just want to understand the story and what this is. They probably won't. I mean, we're doing something very different, and, you know, we're in another country, and, you know, I didn't really know what the donor's motivations were. And so, but I thought, yeah, I was just curious as to, you know, who this person was. And so me and a buddy of mine who was also a Bitcoiner went up for this meeting that we thought was with the donor. And we get there and we meet this guy that's, you know, I think he's probably in his late 50s or early 60s, and we sit down, and he tells us right up front, hey, just let you know, I'm not the donor. Like, the donor wants to remain private. He's very much doesn't want people to, you know, to know who he is. He wants to keep his life normal. And so he has hired me to basically help him navigate and to donate to different organizations. He wants to use the Bitcoin that he was very early in the space and acquired some, you know, what became to be a significant stake of Bitcoin, and wanted to use that to have a big impact on the world. And so,
are you suspicious at all at this point? Are you kind of, I mean, like, or is it just because your buddy had this other guy had a good experience? Because, like, I mean, it almost sounds like a movie or something.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I'm always suspicious. I'm always like, you know, I'm like, wait, where's the scam here? Like, there's not, you know, it was just, but it was funny, because as we're sitting in this meeting, I could tell that the guy that we were working with, super nice guy, great guy, but he wasn't necessarily like a Bitcoiner. You could tell even by the way that, you know, he would describe certain things. I mean, he knew, he understood, you know, but a little bit. You could tell he wasn't, you know, he wasn't like a Mac.
He's transmitting somebody else's message. Yeah.
So it was just, it just seemed like too strange. I'm like, if this was a scam, they would have it much more polished and believable.
Yeah.
It's just too, too crazy. And so we were sitting there and we were talking and I was trying to just get an understanding. Okay. What, you know, what is the motivation of this donor? What does he really want to see? And, I could tell that what he really wanted to see was for Bitcoin to be used as money, for it to be people trading Bitcoin for goods, for it not to be just converted to dollars. You know, that's very easy for organizations to be donated to Bitcoin and just convert to dollars and do things the same fiat way they've always done it. But in talking to, you know, the representative, they made it clear, like, no, that you can't just convert it to dollars, that the Bitcoin actually has to be spent and used as Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And they were having some challenges because of that, because, you know, they're kind of cold calling, you know, some of these organizations saying, like, hey, we want to donate Bitcoin to you, but you can't convert it. Like, you've got to, like, spend it. And I realized what they wanted to see was really a Bitcoin circular economy, like, develop.
Yeah.
You kind of just bypass the fiat system. And so,
I mean, now that makes sense, though, that he'd be reaching out to missionaries, because missionaries generally are on the cutting edge of, especially missions organizations.
Yes,
cutting edge
technology.
Implementing new technology.
Yeah, exactly. I could tell that probably the political leanings of this donor were aligned with mine as far as suspicion of government. But not necessarily with the representative that he had hired. So it was.
Oh, wow.
So I was kind of filtering and realizing that I probably had like a better understanding just because of my my own leanings of what was motivating things here. And so I'm like, hey, this has this crazy, you know, and I was an economics and business major. I always came to Bitcoin, not from the tech side, but from the monetary side of it. And so I was super excited about what they wanted to see. And, you know, I knew it'd be a huge undertaking, but I thought, you know, I have nothing to lose. So I'll swing for the fences here. And so, you know, I said, hey, we'll come back to you with a proposal. And that's basically, we came back with this proposal that, you can actually see, like, if you go to our Twitter handle at Bitcoin Beach, we have the white paper that we published. I think that on the 2.0 version of that, we kind of go through the history of what the original proposal was. And you could see how audacious it was that we were just going to come down to start this, you know, circular Bitcoin economy and draw Bitcoin tourists in. Then we had this whole plan and somehow it actually played out like that. Which, you know how it is, when you make those plans, they never play out like that. But this one actually...
They never play out like that.
And actually faster timeline even than we had anticipated. And so, so came back and said, hey, well, this is what we'll do. You know, I thought for sure they'd be like, oh, you're crazy. You know, this is never going to work. But they came back and had a few questions and then said, all right, let's do it. And then that's, you know... And I've had this experience at other times in my life, like you push and push on something and then they say yes. And you're like, now we actually have to make it happen. And, you know, it can be kind of daunting because you know how much work and, you know, how big of an endeavor it'll be. But it was exciting, too. It was just,
No, I totally understand. It's like it's a new frontier of the battle. So let's go just back a little bit. So how did you, I mean, obviously you said you came into it through the Austrian economic side of things, you know, like philosophical side of things. How did that happen? And like, what timeline are we talking? 2010, you're in there.
I was reading about it. And then, you know, early on there was, you know, there was articles in like the Wall Street Journal and other financial publications talking about this. You know, I had the normal, you know, like feelings of like, oh, this sounds like a Ponzi scheme. But I was very fascinated about the separating money from state component. But I didn't understand the mining. I didn't understand, you know, why more could it be, why you could just replicate it digitally. And so I didn't understand all the reasons that it would work. So I was like, on one hand, very skeptical, but on the other hand, very drawn to it. And then I just kept kind of watching the price volatility and where it was going. probably in 13, I tried to buy some, but it was, you know, once I looked into it, it was like, it's like, oh my gosh, this sounds like a nightmare. And even if I'm able to do it, I'm for sure won't, you know, I'll lose it or won't be able to access it. And so.
Was this still like Mt. Gox days? Like, I have to transfer money to Japan.
Yeah.
And then, like, oh, it just sounds like such a scam.
Yeah. And it's like, wait, what? You gotta look. Yeah. It was, and then not even understanding like how it was held on, you know, at that time there wasn't, I don't think there was any like great hardware wallets or anything like that. It was, you know, and you were already hearing stories of people who had it on their computer and then like lost access to it. And, you know, I have a hard time even controlling my email. And so I'm figuring like, if these, you know, computer geeks are having issues and losing their Bitcoin, like for sure I'm going to. So it wasn't really till much later till, you know, Coinbase had, you know, kind of made it more easy. And, you know, at that time I didn't even understand the, you know, the importance of self-custody and all these things. You know, it takes time. And that's why I always tell people the Bitcoin space, I feel like a lot of people now expect people in El Salvador to like get it overnight. And you're like, no, most of us, it took several years for us to really understand, you know, how Bitcoin actually works and the importance of self-custody and the importance of security and all of these things. But so we shouldn't expect other people to, you know, hit that at day one.
Yeah, it's definitely hypocritical. Okay, so you guys get this donation of Bitcoin. You know, what are kind of your first steps? I mean, you had this white paper, so like, did you just kind of follow that to the T? Like, let me ask you this too: who was involved in writing that white paper? Was that just you, or were there other people involved as well?
So, and you know, the initial it was just kind of a proposal. We incorporated it into the white paper later on, and so we had other people that. But this was, you know, years. You know, at least a year or two after we'd started the project, it was more kind of going back and like, hey, why did this, why was this able to be successful and how did it work? But so, I mean, I guess you could still call the initial proposal a white paper, but it was very unpolished. It was something that I had written. And like I said, it was ironic because usually you write those things, even the most well thought out ones, usually what actually happens looks very different. But this actually transpired in the way that we had envisioned it transpiring, which was, you know.
That's amazing.
Definitely, unusual.
Okay, so what did when was this again? What year is this?
This was 2019.
Okay.
So when we started, and the, you know, initially it was just very small. We had, you know, the small group of young people that we were working with. The first way we started using Bitcoin was to pay them. We'd do cleanups of like the beach or the rivers, and so we would pay them to clean the river after school, just get trash out of it. And we had been doing that with fiat before, and then we switched to start doing it in Bitcoin. And then,
and just to be clear, these are kids who, similar to Jorge, like their fathers or their mothers or both or something are in the United States, trying to earn money to send home to them. Is that kind of, that's a common story?
Yeah, probably. I mean, not all of them, but the majority of them were kind of in that situation. And so they were definitely at that stage where they were very vulnerable. They were vulnerable to being drawn into the gangs. And so it was that kind of stage in life where you can make good decisions and have, you know, a great path ahead, or you can make, you know, a couple bad decisions that set you in the other direction. And so
let me ask you one more question. This is a little more foundational stuff, but like, what, like, how did the gang activity get so bad in El Salvador? Like, is that just, I mean, is that something you have a grasp on? Or
I mean, we could spend all day. I'll try to give you the very short version, but so El Salvador went through a very brutal civil war, you know, primarily during the 80s. It ended in the early 90s. And during that time, a huge portion of the population fled and left for the U.S. And so that's why in El Salvador, you have like 6 or 7 million Salvadorans that live in El Salvador, but there's like 2 to 3 million that live in the U.S. So it's a huge portion of the population left and went to the U.S. And most of them, when they came to the U.S., landed in very bad neighborhoods, specifically in L.A. And to kind of protect themselves from the Mexican gangs at that time, they form their own gangs. And so that is where the 18th Street and Mara Salvatrucha gangs, 13th Street gangs started. And so those are both streets in L.A. And I think it was under Clinton administration, they started deporting a number of these people that had wound up in jail. And they did it in a way they didn't really coordinate it well with the Salvadoran government. A lot of times the government didn't even know that these were people that had been in jail, that were in gangs. And they just started like sending plane loads of them back to El Salvador. And when they arrived, they saw this country that had just come out of a civil war that didn't have a real good security apparatus, because part of the ending of the civil war was part of the peace agreement was really kind of paring back the police force and putting a lot of restrictions on what the police could even do, a lot of restrictions on the size of the military. And so they kind of came into the security void, you know, all these gang members, and they just started replicating what they were doing in L.A. in El Salvador, but specifically focusing on extortion. And so they would basically, you know, form these protection rackets where all the local businesses or individuals would have to pay, you know, for protection. And so that was, you know, where the gangs kind of originated from. And it's very different than like the security issues you see in Mexico that, you know, that, or even in other parts of South America that you're seeing now, most recently in Ecuador, they've had, you know, a pretty bad run. It wasn't really like fueled by drug money or the drug trade. And so it's was very different. You didn't have the gang members weren't living in, you know, riches or driving flashy cars. They were living in poverty, you know, a lot of times in shacks with dirt floors and, you know, living on a few hundred dollars a month. So it wasn't this thing that was driven by easy money. It was more driven by youth looking for a place that they belonged, and the gangs became kind of their family because their parents oftentimes were in the U.S. and so the gangs became this kind of surrogate family for them. But it created this downward spiral in the society where you know, parents would leave because there wasn't a great job opportunities in El Salvador. Then their kids would become very vulnerable to joining the gangs. The gangs kept increasing, which meant there was even less economic opportunity in El Salvador, which meant even more parents would leave. Yeah. So you saw it just getting, you know, worse. You know, every few years, the problems would, you know, double. And so it was kind of this downward spiral.
And so these kids are, you know, their parents are in the States. They're living with grandparents.
Like, yeah, grandparents and uncles, you know, sometimes just kind of off on their own, like they were left with a family member, but the family member was abusing them. And so they're kind of off, you know, living in the streets. And, you know, so just very, very rough situations.
Okay, so you start, you know, paying people in Bitcoin to, you know, clean up trash and do different things. Like what was the initial, you know, reaction to, you know, to that from the part of the kids? Are they just automatically like, okay, we trust you? Or are they kind of like, this seems like a scam? Like, what do you mean you're going to pay me this, you know, digital money?
So originally, you know, we started working with some of the adults because we did different things with adults. We had a number of different initiatives in the community. And so we thought like, okay, this is money and it's kind of serious. We should start with the adults. And we'd see as we'd sit down and try to explain it to the adults, their eyes would just glaze over and they're just looking at us like, you know, yeah, no. And so we were at the same time kind of parallel to this, doing it with the youth specifically on this river cleanup project. And we realized real quickly, they just got it. Like they're already doing things on their phones. And that's one thing that, you know, people in the U.S. don't realize. They underestimate how much smartphones proliferate, even in very, very poor communities. Yeah. They, you know, so even people living in, you know, shacks with dirt floors oftentimes have, you know, at least a basic smartphone. And for these kids, they were just used to doing things on their phones. So for them to have a digital money that would actually open up, you know, opportunities to them to buy things online and other things that they, you know, before hadn't been able to have because they didn't have credit cards or other your bank accounts. And so for them, I think it was a lot easier to accept.
And,
obviously they still went through a learning process, and
there was, an ongoing thing.
Yeah. And so, how many people, how many people are actually undertaking this in the beginning? It's you and Jorge. Like, how many other people are involved with the, the day-to-day stuff?
Yeah, so initially it was Jorge and I, and then we started bringing in, others, specifically, people from the youth would kind of raise up through the project, and so they would kind of serve as, like junior leaders. And then another guy, Roman or Chimbera, as a lot of people know him now, he had been in Europe for a time, but he was a local of El Salvador. He had moved to Europe and for a job opportunity over there. He came back and was very involved from the beginning. So it just kind of started growing. But yeah, from a base of initially, it was just Jorge and I.
Yeah. And so, you're working with people, you're working on these different initiatives. Like, what are some of the pushback you received? You have people earning money. Do you have people, some of these kids who are earning money, are they looking for places to spend the Bitcoin? Are they primarily holding it for a long-term thing? If the initial vision is kind of a circular economy, it would seem that you'd want to, you'd be communicating with shop owners to try to get them to accept Bitcoin. I know that happened at some point, but is that right from the beginning that was happening?
Yeah, no, we knew right from the beginning we needed to have places they'd be able to spend it for them to be able to see it as money. Sure. And so we initially, Jorge's mom had a store that was right on the main road, and it was already kind of the center of a lot of our activities anyways. And so she was the first one, and people have been down to El Zante, and most of them know Mama Rosa's. She's got the best pupusas here in El Zante. And so she was the first one. And, for her, it was more like, okay, my son's saying I need to do this, so I'll do it. What happened as this started to build and gain momentum is the other store owners were like, hey, why is she always so busy? And what's going on over there? And they had occasionally asked, the kids asked them, like, hey, do you take Bitcoin? And they're like, wait, what? They had no idea what it was. And so it was something that over time, then they'd come and say, either we'd go to them or sometimes they would come to us and say, hey, how do I get involved with it? And how does it work? And so that was kind of a balance as we had more people receiving Bitcoin. We've tried to onboard more stores, but doing it in a manner so that it was worthwhile for the stores. They had enough people using it there. And then that kind of was all turbocharged when COVID hit. We really ramped everything up because we wanted to be very careful, initially from working overseas, you want to be very careful about giving people things for free, especially money, because it can create dependencies, it can distort the local economy, it can have all these unintended consequences. So we were trying to kind of go slow and methodical and make sure that we weren't doing harm to the community when we, because you see that oftentimes happen. But during COVID, it kind of unshackled us because nobody could work. So it wasn't like, hey, if we're, giving people Bitcoin, it's going to disincentivize them to work. Everybody was supposed to stay home. All the businesses shut down except for, food stores and restaurants. And people were literally going hungry. And so at that time, we rolled out this community-wide program of sending all the families in El Zante enough Bitcoin to buy, at least a good portion of their basics. It wasn't like they were, receiving a crazy amount, but it was, enough to buy their, half their beans and rice that they needed for the month.
That's cool.
And they were able to use, other savings or other things they do to get the other basics. But it really was that bridge to get them through that time. And because of that, we had, everybody in the community, understanding at least the basics about Bitcoin, how to use it. We had switched to using Lightning at that point, and so it made it very user-friendly.
Okay. Yeah, and so I think that's a big challenge is, again, just the technicality of it. But the verse that I talked about that comes to mind a lot and that I share with people is, Jesus' verse where he says, those who are well have no need of a physician. It's those who are sick. And so, like, a lot of the people, when Jesus is talking, they don't have the time of day for him because they don't have, they didn't see themselves as being as needy. But I can imagine something like COVID where, you know, these people were like, where's my, I can't work my normal job. You know, where's my food going to come from? And then all of a sudden, you know, Bitcoin comes along and, you know, you guys are offering it to them. It's a huge incentive for them to invest the time to try to understand it. So,
well, the other thing was, you know, yeah,
pretty providential thing.
The other thing was they had lots of time because they were bored.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're sitting around. And so it was a very opportune time for them to start, you know, watching videos on it or, you know, yeah, reading about it. And so it really was a perfect storm for you know, in order to turbocharge Bitcoin adoption.
Yeah. But real quick, what month did you launch in 2019?
So we launched probably in August, September of 2019. And then that fall, we went down to the BitConf conference that was in Uruguay. I think you were there.
I know.
You didn't even come to the conference. So
it kills me. The reason I ask about the timing is because I really got in hardcore into Bitcoin in May of 2019. But even though I was just listening to, you know, just generic resources online, I had no clue about La BitConf. I didn't have any idea that, like, you and Jimmy Song was in Uruguay, like, right?
he was at that one. Yeah, he was one of the first speakers I saw at that conference.
Yeah. Well, and literally where you guys were was, I mean, 5 minutes from my house. Like, it's crazy how how close you were. So you guys go down there. What was the primary, you know, motivation for going there? Was it just kind of to spread the word about the project or?
No, I assume that there was a bunch of Bitcoin circular economies out there that were, like, doing this.
Yeah.
And so my objective was to go down there and like find out where these other projects were and then be able to just copy what they were doing and you know, understand that. And so we went down there. We brought some of our team down. Jorge and another guy, Juan, came and Peter. The objective was, let's find out what these other are doing. And as we started talking to people, they're like, no, you guys are, like, further along than anybody else. And that was very daunting because that was like, well, if somebody else is doing this, maybe it's impossible.
Yeah.
Like, what, are we crazy? But the other thing that happened during that conference was at the end of it, I went up and introduced myself to Peter McCormick. He was one of the speakers there, and I had been listening to his podcast. And I said, hey, we have this project in El Salvador. I'd love for you to come, like, see it and do a podcast on it. And he's like, well, I'm leaving tonight for Bolivia, but I can be there on Thursday. And, you know, I was thinking more like a year from then. You know, it was just kind of putting it in his head. But he was, and that's what I love about Peter. He just, he does the work. I mean, he just grinds it out. He's been all over the world. Yeah. Boots on the ground, like seeing the real deal. So a few days later, this was the end of the time in Uruguay. I got home, and then 2 days later, Peter showed up, and I think he hadn't slept in like 48 hours. And so he slept in the missionary guest house that we had. He crashed in there, and I think he slept for like 14 hours because he had it was. And then he actually did his first Lightning transactions in El Zante, buying pupusas. And so he helped me get on Twitter. You know, he's like, no, you got to be on Twitter, like, if you're going to do this, and help me get the first followers. And but at that time there was, like, you know, 10 kids. It was this little thing. And he told me later, he's like, oh, I thought this totally is never going to work. Like, you know, it was when he came back, you know, like a year later, he was, I think, very surprised how it had taken off.
That's so funny. All right. So you guys get back, you guys start going to work. Like, was it just more of the same? Like, it just took time, you know, you have more interest, more people coming, and then kind of word spreads? Or, I mean, like, what did it look like beyond those first few months?
Yeah, we just started expanding it into more programs. We started figuring out ways we could incorporate Bitcoin. So one of the things we did was start to give stipends to the kids that for getting good grades in school. We rolled out a program to work with the families that had, you know, either mental or physical challenges, you know, with a family member, and that we would give them like a stipend that would kind of help with some of the special needs that they had because of those unique challenges, that we pay that in Bitcoin. We just started doing a number of different, you know, we were doing projects helping repair homes and things like that, where we would pay the construction workers in Bitcoin. Actually, post-COVID, we hired probably about 100 people in the community to do these things because everybody had been out of work. And,
yes,
you know, we'd been working with a lot of them beforehand. And a lot of, you know, there's a lot of guys that were recovering from recovering alcoholics, and they like made good progress. And we didn't want to see them slip back in that desperation. And we knew it would take a little time for the economy to ramp back up. And so we also worked with businesses that if they would bring their employees back, that we would pay half their salary in Bitcoin for the first few months. We try to encourage them to bring the employees back early on. And so we had this program where we had, I think initially it was like 100 people that were working, doing road repairs, you know, working on homes of the elderly, doing these things. But we structured it in a way that it was the wages being paid were on the low end, and it wasn't full time, it was part time, because we didn't want them to see this as like, oh, I just need to keep this job. Yeah. We wanted to see them to see it as like, okay, this is a bridge till I can find something better. And it worked out great like that. We saw it, you know, every month we'd have, you know, a couple dozen of people would drop off, and, you know, when after like 4 or 5 months we kind of shut down that program, and I think it made a big difference in the way the community recovered, because you had everybody kind of get back to work, and things recovered much quicker than they did in neighboring communities.
Yeah. And it's were there lockdowns in El Salvador, or again, El Zante is pretty far from the city center. It's, you know, you're definitely not going to be able to enforce it.
It was very extreme lockdowns. The president of El Salvador actually closed like the international airports like overnight before even a single case of COVID had been discovered in the country. And so you had foreigners that were locked in El Salvador that couldn't get out because they had gone on vacation there. You had both of my kids had friends whose parents were stuck in the U.S., like they had gone to the U.S. for something, and, you know, Salvadoran parents, and they had, like, you know, both of them went to private schools, and so, you know, a lot of their friends were, like, from the wealthy families there that would fly to Miami for the weekend to go shopping.
Yeah.
So they had friends whose moms had flown to Miami to go shopping and couldn't get back in for 6 months. So it was...
6 months?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So we were actually in El Salvador, and then they... Initially, it was just they closed the borders, but then they basically... You weren't allowed to leave your house. So, and they had soldiers patrolling the streets. They went... Way, I mean, I was in complete disagreement with the way that they handled it. It was a very severe lockdown. You know, you couldn't even go to the beach. You couldn't do anything. Yeah. And we eventually,
you're saying that's why these guys were out of work or were out of jobs, because the lockdown was so severe.
Yeah, they were.
What was the expectation on the part of the government that people were going to do to continue to pay for themselves, like to, you know, pay for their lives and stuff?
I'm not exactly sure. They did do some. I think they did something where every family got like $300, like as you know, to kind of help them through. And then the military started delivering food to the different houses. So it was, you know, they did make some efforts, but it was still, you know, you got all these, majority of people are unbanked. Even when they tried to do the distribution of funds, it was a nightmare. It was definitely a lot of hardships and definitely a lot of people going hungry. I mean, they're resourceful. You know, people would, you know, they would find ways to work even when they weren't supposed to. And, you know, there was some, like, you know, what were considered essential businesses that were allowed to stay open. But even those struggled because nobody had any money. And so it really, the economy just got hammered during that time.
Yeah.
But
so you were saying at some point you went back to the States?
Yeah. So we eventually got out on like an emergency evacuation flight. It took us a few months. We were helping. There was the number of the missionaries that we were working with. They were trying to get out. Some of them were like pregnant and were, you know, wanted to go back to the U.S. and have their kids. And there was different kind of, emergency situations. So we stayed for a while just trying to work with them. We had, you know, a relationship with folks at the U.S. Embassy. And so we were working with them when there would be openings on these flights. And I think we finally left in May. We got on an evacuation flight and got out. It was bizarre. Like, it was the only flight leaving the airport that day. Like, everything, it was like this dystopian movie.
Yeah. And were you guys going back at that point, just because you're like, we need a break, or was it was to work at the fairs
again? Well, that was, we needed to go back because at that time we didn't know if our business was going to operate. It wound up not operating.
Gotcha.
It's not because we were shut down, but at that time it was still like up in the air whether or not we were going to operate or not. So we needed to get back for that. We would usually go back. I would generally go back in May. And anyways, my family would follow in June when they got out of school. And so, you know, the kids were obviously online at that point. So, but it also was, we were tired of being like locked in our house, and that was getting very old. And so we definitely wanted to get out of the country at that point. And it felt, it felt daunting to have soldiers outside, you know, it felt very dystopian.
No. Yeah, are they imprisoning people, or are they just like finding people? Or is it more just like they're just there to let you know you need to be inside?
No, they were picking up people if they found you out on the streets and you weren't supposed to be. They would actually they set up all these COVID centers. So if you had COVID, they would actually come and get you and put you in one of these quarantine centers, which, you know, that was scary just in itself, but. They were also picking up people that were breaking quarantine and putting them in the quarantine centers, which didn't make a lot of sense. Yeah. So it was, people were very fearful to go out. You were allowed to go to the store. You know, eventually they made it. It was, I think, like once a week. But you could only have, you couldn't have anybody in the car with you. And you had to have like a list of groceries you were getting and prove you were going to the store. And so the benefit was at that time there was a real sense that the foreigners were the disease carriers. So you would pull up with the security guard, you roll down your window, and they see that you're white, and they would like step back and wave you on because they're afraid they're going to get COVID.
They're going to get
you. So that was the only time I felt like not super welcome in the country was there was this, the fear level was just off the charts. And so anybody that, you know, and you read about that's what happened was anytime there's these different crises, people tend to single out people that are foreign or look different or something different about them. And so, yeah, that was the only time I ever felt like unwelcomed in El Salvador.
Yeah. So who is kind of, so while you're gone for, you end up being gone three, four months?
Yeah, we usually, in general, that would be what would be gone during the summer. It worked about the same that year.
Yeah. And so then, when you guys go back, you guys already kind of have processes in place. You have people in place. So, I mean, things just keep humming when you're not there.
Yeah.
I think, like, that's, like, one of the things that maybe people don't realize is, like, and again, you're quick to, you know, pop this, you know, this illusionary bubble here of, like, Mike is the guy doing everything. It's just like, no. There's like a whole team of
folks
who are working.
I mean, I was very behind the scenes. They were the ones on the ground doing all the hard work. I mean, I was more just like quarterbacking of it and coming up with the crazy ideas. And then they had to figure out the way to implement them. And you know, anybody who's had a business or done any type of endeavor, you know, ideas are easy, but actually making them work, that's where the hard work comes in. So I give all credit to the team. They're the ones that made everything happen.
Well, yeah, here we are. We're now 3 years removed from that. You know, where are things now in Bitcoin Beach? Like, kind of like what do things look like, and what are still the, you know, maybe the things on the time horizon, or things on the schedule that you guys haven't quite reached that you're hoping to reach, you know, soon? Are there anything like that? Or you guys, it's mainly just keep doing what we're doing and, you know, keep growing gradually. What do things look like there right now?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things we just keep in mind is these changes is, you know, especially when it comes to Bitcoin adoption, like they are long-term changes. These are generational things for them to play out. So we're seeing huge strides. I mean, the economy in El Zante is just off the charts. I mean, they're literally now there's like a crane, you know, a building crane in front of, I mean, you'd be shocked to see there's a building crane in front of our house. You know, it looks like I'm like, where are we at? Shanghai here? Like it's, you know, it's a little beach town and now there's huge, you know, towers going up. You know, the economy's booming, tourism's booming. We're working with the Department of Education, with the government to roll out Bitcoin curriculum across the entire school system. So we've already trained, a couple thousand teachers. And, you know, it's rolled out in a good portion of the country. But their plan is to have this integrated to the entire school system. And then they're also going to have another program even for the young elementary school kids. And so focusing on that. And then we have also seen, you know, as word got out about what was happening here, there was all these other communities around the world that sprung up and wanted to kind of replicate what happened at El Zante. And so I spend probably the majority of my time now working with these other communities all around the world that have sprung up, trying to, you know, help them raise funds, help them kind of think through how their operations are going to be, help them learn from our mistakes so they don't have to reinvent the wheel, and spend a lot of time on that. So it's become very much an international endeavor.
What are some of these? I know like Motive is in Peru. You've got Bitcoin Akasi, which is what part of Africa is that in?
That's in South Africa. And those are they.
What are some of these other projects maybe that aren't as well known or that are more fledgling?
So there's Bitcoin Lake and
that's right
in Guatemala at Lake Panajachel. There's Bitcoin Jungle in Costa Rica.
Yeah.
There's Praia Bitcoin in Brazil. There's Kampala Bitcoin in Uganda. There's Bitcoin Bali. There's Bitcoin Witsand in South Africa. There's a bunch in Africa that are happening right now.
Okay.
Yeah. So that I would say Africa probably has the largest number of projects just as far as number of them. You know, a lot of them are very small and fledgling at this point. You know, versus like you have like Motive in Peru, which is also was started by a missionary down there in Peru.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're working in 15 different communities throughout Peru and have like a giant operation and impact. And so, it's
shout to Valley. We love Valley.
Valentin is the man. So,
yeah. Okay, cool. Well, if there's, I guess, if you know, if you're, I mean, the majority of people who listen to this podcast are into Bitcoin already, but we do get people who aren't, you know, this might be their first touch with Bitcoin. Like what is something, you know, that you'd want to leave with people who maybe, again, at this point are still thinking of Bitcoin as, you know, they're primarily looking at it through like the speculative investment vehicle. Kind of what would you say to them to kind of try to expand? I mean, you've already talked about this a lot, but like, what are some of the things that maybe aren't intuitive for somebody who's new to Bitcoin to think about and that you know, you feel like would be helpful for them to kind of grasp, get a bigger grasp of what Bitcoin is and the implications that it's having around the world?
I think it's important for people to realize like that the majority of the world doesn't have access to the financial system and especially in a way that's fair. When they do have access, it's very expensive and a lot of times used to exploit them. And I think most Americans just assume that, well, there's all these phone apps and so, you know, they must have Zelle or Venmo or these different. No, the majority of the world, those things don't exist. And the reason is not even like a technological reason. The reason is more a regulatory one of, you know, the U.S. laws that for some reason our government thinks they should apply to the whole world, however the U.S. wants them. Yeah. They put these restrictions and these requirements for know your customer or for anti-money laundering laws that really make it uneconomical to bank the majority of the world because it adds this cost. And when you're dealing with poor people, there's not really that much profit to be made. So if you add this cost on top of it, it keeps most of the world unbanked. And so Bitcoin is really remarkable in that it is permissionless. They don't need to have permission from any type of intermediary. So it really levels the playing field and allows, you know, the poorest of the poor to have the same access as you or I can have. And so that is crucial to bringing people out of poverty, for them to have access to a financial system that's fair and that's not weighted against them. And so, you know, there's obviously a lot of different other values. There's a lot of practical things, but I think that's the most important thing that especially most Americans miss out on is how much different it is for most of the world that doesn't have the privileges, the financial system that works in the way that people in the U.S. do.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is one of the big barriers that we run up against a lot in talking to people is they're thinking about this, which makes sense, but they're thinking about it from an American standpoint, American point of view, and they're missing, you know, tons of elements. The fact that, hey, the majority of the world, you are the historical anomaly. The things that you have available to you are statistically, just no one in world history has had what you have. And to this day, there's, you know, the majority of people don't have those resources. I'll finish with this question because this is a little, closer to home for me. So is this, you guys obviously, Mission Stake is a missions organization to some degree. You guys are, have contact with missionaries, you work with missionaries. Do you see any movement on a missionary organization level for them adopting Bitcoin? Do you see those things? Are you having those kind of conversations, or is that still too early at this point?
No, we're definitely having those conversations, and really on two different planes. One is talking with organizations that are just having the challenge getting funds into certain parts of the world, especially ones that, try to really make it hard for missionaries to operate, actively or trying to restrict them. And so Bitcoin is a way for them to kind of bypass, these walls that get thrown up in order to get money to the support what they're doing there. The other is specifically organizations that are working and trying to do poverty alleviation type operations and economic development. Bitcoin really changes the way people think about things. And, I tell people it's like the secret sauce that I feel like economic development has been missing. Like most economic development efforts are just super wasteful and have very little long-term impact and a lot of times have negative impact. And because a lot of times they just create dependency, they distort, the local economy so that things are not done in a way that makes long-term economic sense. There's all these second and third order impacts that a lot of times are negative. But Bitcoin, when people start using Bitcoin, they become financially educated on their own. It really drives them to start thinking, what is money? Why is Bitcoin money? Okay, why is the dollar money? It helps them think through, and it also helps slow lower their time preference, where they really start thinking about saving versus spending. And we've seen that carries over even into education. Once they start realizing, hey, the deferred gratification of saving versus spending and have this, when you're holding an asset that's going to be worth more in the future, that makes a lot of sense. When you're holding dollars, it doesn't make sense because they just keep getting worth less and less. So it's like we should spend them as fast as we can, even more so if you're using a currency that loses its value faster than the dollar. And so we have this system that is set up to discourage savings, where when they switch to Bitcoin, they really start to save for the first time. But it also bleeds over even into education, where it helps them think through, okay, if I'm continuing in school rather than working now, I'm sacrificing income, but I'm putting myself in position to earn more and to do something that's going to be more meaningful longer term. And so it helps them just reorient how they think about things. And so I think we're going to see both in the missions world, but even in the broader development world, people realizing that if you switch out from using fiat and use Bitcoin instead, you are going to have exponentially better outcomes.
I just think, again, this is my thing is, like, you're trying not to just sound like the crazy person. Like, you already sound like the crazy person just talking about Bitcoin at all. And I mean, just, but when you're, I mean, I, again, we've talked about this thing, is like, the thing that just gets me, that I just think about over and over again, is, again, you have this ticking clock of, you know, of your resources that these churches have. Like, when that's when you realize that you will, at least in dollar terms, there's many missions organizations that will never have as much purchasing power as they have right now. Like, that is one of these things in my mind. Like, it just changes. Now, and it can be discouraging, honestly, because you're just like, you know, you're sitting there trying to help people see this issue and trying to help people see the ticking clock, you know, that they're on. We talked about this in a previous episode, but my alma mater just closed like 2 months ago.
Oh, really?
My college did. Yeah, they couldn't make the economics work anymore. And I mean, that's been happening. There's more and more missions organizations that are closing, and it's the ones who are small and nimble enough, willing to consider the unconsiderable. I just think it's a really, really tough challenge. And I'm sitting here always looking for people who are having these kind of conversations and looking for encouragement. And I know there's a bunch of our listeners who are in similar boats, right? They're in churches, or they're, you know, advising Christian schools or whatever it is. And they're constantly just looking for, just looking for encouragement and looking for new angles on you know, ways to talk with people. But Mike, I just want to thank you so much for your time. And again, this won't be the last time we have you on. It's taken too long, and we'll get you back on here before too long and get a report on El Salvador. So
awesome.
I'll give you the last word. Go for it.
I would just like to encourage people that haven't been down to El Salvador to come down and check out what's happening here. If you're curious and you know, want to be able to listen to what's going on here, we do have a podcast live from Bitcoin Beach. We've talked about Bitcoin, but also just, you know, El Salvador in general. We kind of combine those two things. And then if you have, if you're thinking of a way to be a good steward with your resources, definitely encourage you to understand Bitcoin and how that's going to affect the church and ministries. Try to get off the fiat treadmill and use, you know, really sound money, I think is going to make ministries much more effective and efficient.
Yeah. And Mike, people can find you on Twitter as @BitcoinBeach. Is there a website? Obviously, I think there is a website for Bitcoin Beach.
Yeah, the website is BitcoinBeach.com. And Twitter. Yeah, Twitter, we usually keep things more up to date on Twitter than the website. We try to keep the website up to date. We actually recently did a big update on it, so it's actually current right now.
That's cool.
Yeah. So if you want to know like events that are happening, you know, in the next couple of weeks, the Twitter is definitely better.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Mike. Appreciate your help. And again, for our listeners, thank you for your constant support. This episode in part is brought to you by River.com. River is the place that we recommend people go to learn about Bitcoin and buy Bitcoin. They are, the most trusted people in the business. They're doing things the right way. You can find out more information and basically sign up to get more information with them at river.com/TGFB. Again, we'll be back very soon. I've got a couple more interviews lined up.
Just one plug for River. I haven't personally used them, but they're the one Bitcoin company that I've never heard anybody say anything negative about. Like everybody, everybody who uses River just raves about them. So
we appreciate those guys. So thank you, Alex, Ben, our friends over there. I appreciate you guys. And yeah, we'll be back on the next episode of the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.